From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the CIA planned to kill al-Qaeda leaders, which was kept secret from Congress by order of former Vice President Dick Cheney. The plan, which was never carried out, was recently canceled by Leon Panetta, the new head of the CIA. We'll talk about the secret plan with Jane Mayer, who has written investigative pieces on the Bush administration war on terror for The New Yorker. She recently wrote about the dilemmas facing Leon Panetta. Also, a reporter who stayed in Iran after foreign reporters were forced out. We talk with New York Times columnist Roger Cohn about witnessing the protests and how he managed to stay in Tehran and safely get out. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New questions about alleged abuses in the Bush administration war on terror have been raised by a recent series of damaging revelations, including the revelation about a secret CIA anti-terror program. The CIA hid the program from Congress for 8 years, apparently at the direction of Vice President Dick Cheney. Several national news organizations now report that the program involved assembling secret hit teams to kill al-Qaeda operatives in other countries. The program, which was never operational, was recently canceled by the new CIA chief, Leon Panetta. Our guest, Jane Mayer, has written extensively about the intelligence community and the war on terror for The New Yorker. Her latest article was about Leon Panetta and whether he can move the CIA forward without confronting its past. She's also the author of the bestseller, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Mayer spoke this morning to Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Jane Mayer, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, the nation, of course, has paid a lot of attention in recent days to revelations by the CIA director, Leon Panetta, that Congress had been kept in the dark for 8 years about a secret anti-terror program run by the CIA. What do we know about this program now?
Well, we still don't know all of the details, but it sounds like, from the reports that have been out there, that it was a program to form a kind of a death squad unit that would rove the world in search of al-Qaeda leaders who, under this program, could be targeted for killing.
So assassinations outside the United States, as far as we know, right?
Well, assassination is actually a term that suggests illegal activity. Huh. And so targeted killing is what it would have been called, because that suggests then that it was legally authorized.
And as far as the reporting reveals, so far never actually implemented, right?
That's right. Though there does seem to be some suggestion that the unit was set up, and but that it never became operational. It was somewhere between an idea and an actual program. They began to take a close look into setting it up, and I think maybe began to train people slightly. But those are the details that we're still trying to ferret out.
And is it clear that Vice President Dick Cheney was largely responsible for keeping this secret from Congress?
Well, that is what the current CIA director, Panetta, told the committees, the Intelligence Oversight Committees. So, and so far, it remains undisputed. So I guess we can assume that former Vice President Cheney truly did try to purposefully keep this information from Congress.
Now, congressional leaders are furious about this, but I'm sure a lot of Americans wouldn't necessarily expect that the CIA would talk about its most sensitive covert operations, even in closed doors with congressional leaders. What exactly is the obligation of the CIA to disclose these kinds of operations?
Well, I mean, the problem is that there is a legal requirement that the CIA disclose these kinds of operations. It's not up to the executive branch whether to inform the congressional overseers of covert programs and other important intelligence activities. Under statute, the CIA is required to disclose these kinds of details. There's some leeway in terms of how quickly they need to disclose them, and there's some interpretive leeway also about what kinds of programs must be disclosed. They have to be important programs. But they don't necessarily have to be operational programs. They have to even inform Congress when they are considering important covert operations.
Now, you and others have written about the tendency of Vice President Cheney and his chief of staff, David Addington, to take different, perhaps somewhat more innovative views of the reach of executive power. Do we know if this is an area in which they also had a different view of the intelligence community, the executive branch's legal obligations to inform Congress?
Definitely. This is a key area where there's a long history here, long and very fraught, basically, where former Vice President Cheney has resented the role of Congress in overseeing intelligence operations and in, as he sees it, interfering in the executive branch's right to conduct national security and foreign affairs. So this goes way back. We're talking about to the 1970s, basically. So maybe it's worth sort of filling in some of the history here if you want.
Well, you know, and the history involves what were then called assassinations, and which, as you say now, targeted killing may be the preferred term. But back in the 70s, there was an enormous outcry about the CIA's activities abroad that involved killings of perceived enemies of the United States. It led to, the church hearings in Congress and new rules for this. To what extent are we...
Specifically those kind of activities, which is the irony here, it was specifically reports of assassination attempts that created these oversight rules. And so if you go back to the beginning, basically the CIA was founded in 1947, and at the time there was concern that it's very hard to balance a secret intelligence organization inside an open democracy. So they set the CIA up, and they specifically worried at the time that we did not want in this country to have something like the KGB or like the East German secret police. So they set boundaries, among which were that the CIA cannot operate in our own country. Then in the 1970s, a number of abuses surfaced, and there became this, as you mentioned, the Church Committee, a congressional investigation that looked into allegations that the CIA was engaged in an assassination plot against Castro, one against an African leader, Lumumba. There were reports of interferences in elections in Latin America. There were reports about mind control experiments with drugs on human beings that were being done, including one that resulted in a death of somebody jumping out of a window after having been given LSD without knowing about it. There were also questions of illegal break-ins, including some into the private property of anti-war protesters in this country during the Vietnam War years, where the CIA assisted the FBI in particular in breaking into the psychiatric office of a doctor who was treating an anti-war protester. So these sorts of things became fodder for national scandal and outrage, and the result was an effort to try to reform the CIA. And the thought was that if Congress was authorized and required to perform an oversight role, that there would be some checks and balances put in place on what the CIA was doing. It was very much a kind of mirroring what we do in other parts of the government, where you have outside independent review in order to check abuses. And so that's how these oversight rules got set up in the first place.
Dick Cheney was a player back in the 70s. Remind us where he was and how this experience informed his own views then and now about the CIA and its relationship with congressional oversight.
At the time, Vice President Cheney was the chief of staff to former President Gerald Ford, and he was in the White House when some of these scandals were breaking, and he from the time, and he's written about it, talked about it, he has looked at the Congress as having an illegitimate role here in trying to break the role that the executive branch, as he sees it, should play. So he's described Congress as gnats in the past, and his top lawyer, David Addington, who actually was a lawyer at the CIA in the 80s, the two of them have worked hard to try to minimize the role of Congress and maximize the role of the executive branch. So there's been this ongoing fight, and under Cheney's interpretation, he really feels that you need to have a strong executive in order to have a strong America, and that Congress shouldn't interfere.
Then there was the Iran-Contra affair, and Dick Cheney was in Congress at the time. Remind us briefly what that was about and what Cheney's views were then.
Basically, this was when Reagan was president. Reagan wanted to fund the one side in the Nicaraguan Civil War, and Congress explicitly forbade the White House from funding one side in the war. They didn't want to get involved in this, and but the White House went ahead and did it anyway, along with the CIA. And what they did was they funded the Contras with money that was raised abroad instead of getting it out of Congress. Congress was furious when they found out. There were all kinds of hearings, and many legal repercussions. But throughout this whole thing, what was interesting is that Cheney always took the side of the White House, even though he was in Congress. He thought that it was up to the president to make foreign policy.
Now, apart from the battles of the 1970s changing the relationship between the CIA and Congress, it also changed the CIA and its conception of itself. And I'm wondering, as somebody who follows the intelligence community, are you surprised to see a renewed interest in the CIA in developing, well, targeted killing squads?
Well, I mean, I think you have to understand where this is coming from. It was right after 9/11, and the Bush White House was panicking about the possibility of another attack from al-Qaeda. And they basically pulled out all the stops and decided they would do everything they could possibly think of. And the same with the CIA, which came the week after 9/11, went over to the White House with a list of things that they would like to do. And this was on the list.
And you know, of course, there have been efforts to kill al-Qaeda leaders going back through the 1990s, usually using guided missile strikes or drone aircraft. What's the difference between the military undertaking a killing of an al-Qaeda operative and the CIA doing it?
Well, the problem beneath all of this, it's very complicated, but the problem is, you know, are whether or not you regard al-Qaeda leaders as suspects in crimes or if they are warriors in a war. There's one set of laws that governs how we treat people in wars and another if they are criminals. And so there's been a lot of confusion about sort of blurring the barriers there. After 9/11, we basically went to war against al-Qaeda. So the laws of war should have applied to the al-Qaeda leaders here.
So then a military attack against an enemy of the United States is different from a killing of someone who is a suspected criminal. If the government views us as being at war with architects of terror, can the CIA be, in effect, employed as a military asset and conduct those killings around the world?
Right. It conceivably, you can argue that they have the right to kill the enemy because we're at war with the enemy. And Congress wrote up the authorization to use military force, which gave the U.S. the power to go to war against the leaders of al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The question, though, is where's the battlefield? You can, under the rules of law, you can kill people, the enemy on the battlefield, but you can't necessarily chase them into sovereign states that are not part of this battle.
We're speaking with Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Jane Mayer. She is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she's written on security and intelligence issues. She's also the author of the book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. You know, the battle that we're seeing now is not just about whether or not Congress should be briefed about some of these activities, but it really reflects this question of to what extent the Obama administration will now look back and hold Bush administrations accountable for alleged violations of law in its security activities, or in the interest of, you know, political compromise and national unity, let some of those things go and move on to a more forward-thinking agenda. Is this going to make it harder for Obama to confront that dilemma?
Well, I mean, the problem is that from the start – Even before he was elected, Obama made a major issue of Bush's policies in the war on terror. He was an outspoken critic of them. So when he took over the White House, people expected him to end these policies and hold wrongdoers accountable. But he kind of instead, when he took over, said that we will fix what went wrong, but we don't want to look back. We want to look forward and not get caught up in punishing people who may have done wrong during these past years. It's been a very hard line to walk, though, and it's getting harder all the time because there's more and more information suggesting there was serious wrongdoing of various sorts that took place during the Bush years.
And each time a new revelation emerges, he is called upon to comment and maybe confront a new decision about whether there should be an investigation.
Right? Absolutely. I mean, and so the thing is, the choice becomes, does he want to open up the past or does he want to cover up the past? And instead, he's looking for some kind of middle ground where he can be neutral on this issue, not covering up necessarily for Bush, but also not getting dragged into partisan fights about prosecuting his predecessors. And it's a swamp that he keeps getting dragged into.
And then there's this still pending decision by the Attorney General Eric Holder on whether there will be investigations into those who developed the legal authority for enhanced interrogation techniques, torture. Now, help us understand this. I believe the administration has said that they will not investigate or prosecute people who were acting within the legal limits that the Justice Department defined at the time. Is that right?
Right. So basically they're trying to inoculate the CIA officers who were acting in good faith and were told that what they were doing was legal, because it would seem unfair to go back at them now and change the rules on them. And so they've also said, that the Obama administration, that is, that they are not likely to prosecute the lawyers whose interpretations of the laws were so controversial. So what's left then is the question. And it seems from recent reports that Attorney General Holder is looking at the possibility of appointing a special prosecutor who would investigate whether interrogators themselves, the people in the room with those terror suspects, whether they crossed over the line criminally, whether they went beyond even the very generous kinds of interpretations of law that the Justice Department during the Bush years gave them.
What might be the fallout from prosecuting those who actually inflicted torture?
Well, I think the problem may be that the actual interrogators would argue immediately that they were authorized to do everything they did, and they would then point straight up the chain of command and say that the blame should be pushed upwards to the very top of the Bush administration, which, after all, signed off on this program, including the president, the vice president, the director of the CIA, and the Secretary of Defense. So it's very hard to contain this at the very bottom rungs of the program, and I think that's what they would find very quickly.
You know, with the revelations that have come out over the past, days and weeks, do you think the balance has shifted in terms of the pressure on President Obama to more aggressively investigate alleged wrongdoing during the Bush days? Or will he stay on the course that he has charted so far to do as little as possible?
You know, I just don't know that he can stay on this course. I understand very much why he wants to do it. This, he doesn't want to tangle his presidency up in endlessly trying to deal with the problems that the former president created in the war on terror. And, clearly President Obama's got his own positive agenda. He wants to deal with health care. He wants to deal with the economy. The country probably agrees with his priorities in many ways. Yet there is something about these legal problems that are coming out of the Bush years that you can't just sweep under the rug. And I've been interviewing a number of experts on this area who say it's very much the experience that other countries have had, when they've had scandals that involved allegations of torture, frequently everybody wants to just fix it and move on, but it doesn't go away. That these allegations are so serious and they strike so much at the core of our values that people don't feel comfortable just letting perpetrators off the hook. And so it just keeps bubbling up and bubbling up until there's some kind of either a Truth and Reconciliation Commission or some kinds of prosecutions or some way of just opening up what happened here. Because, you know, we're an open society and torture is a major crime. So it's very hard to forget it.
You know, there are also international obligations which may force the United States' hand in dealing with issues of torture. And we've seen efforts by a Spanish judge to bring some Bush administration officials to account. Where is that going to go? What impact will that have on the Obama administration's actions?
Well, this is another problem for the administration, because Eric Holder may not be free to ignore these allegations of torture. As you say, under international law, the Convention Against Torture requires the United States to investigate if there are credible allegations of torture. And if we don't do it, other countries will, which creates a very uncomfortable situation, as we've seen in Spain, so where they've started to take, you know, open up a criminal investigation into the U.S. So, again, Holder may not be free to just move on without looking at this.
Jane Mayer will continue her interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies in the second half of the show. Jane Mayer writes for The New Yorker magazine. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, working to help vulnerable kids, families, and communities succeed at aecf.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the challenge of reforming the CIA. We talk with Jane Mayer about Leon Panetta, the new head of the agency. She profiled him last month in The New Yorker. And we talk with New York Times columnist Roger Cohn about staying in Tehran to cover the protests after all foreign press passes were revoked by the Iranian government. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leon Panetta, the new head of the CIA, just revealed to Congress that the CIA had a secret program under the Bush administration to kill al-Qaeda operatives, a program that it kept hidden from Congress. Our guest Jane Mayer recently wrote a New Yorker article about Leon Panetta and what he faces at the CIA. Mayer is a staff writer for the magazine and is the author of the bestseller The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Let's get back to her interview with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
You wrote recently in The New Yorker about Leon Panetta and his efforts to reform the CIA and confront the dilemmas it faces about its recent past. One of the first things Panetta had to confront was whether he had an agency in which operatives under his command had committed torture. Is it clear whether that was the case?
Well, the thing is, it depends whose definition of torture. In the Bush years, the lawyers said that the things that were done in these interrogation programs were not torture. Many outside experts have said this clearly was torture, including the Red Cross, which is pretty much the world's expert on torture and war crimes. So there's a fight on about whether what was done constituted criminal actions or not. And, many people think that this was a program of torture.
Now, you tell us in the piece that when Leon Panetta came in, he said he wanted to be sure that nobody on the CIA payroll could be prosecuted for torture or related crimes. How did he go about ensuring that that was the case?
Well, he asked the Inspector General, John Helgerson at the time, whether Helgerson thought there were people there who had committed crimes.
That's the Inspector General of the CIA, right?
That's right. And whether people needed to be investigated further there. And interestingly, Helgerson said he did not think there were no people he knew of at the time who had committed crimes, but he also left the door open saying, potentially more could be found out about people.
So where does that leave Panetta? I mean, what standard did he employ?
Panetta's in a tough spot. He wants to win over the loyalty of the building. He doesn't want to alienate the people who he is the boss of. And so he pretty much has decided to take the same line as President Obama, saying if these acts were authorized by lawyers in the Bush administration, then he doesn't think people should be prosecuted now that we're reinterpreting the law. So he seems to be, to some extent, accepting what was done before and trying to move forward.
Now, one of the things that President Obama has said is there's going to be a new era of openness and transparency. To what extent has Panetta done that, or maybe been more protective of the CIA when it comes to the disclosure of past deeds and memoranda and reports?
Well, he has kind of moved back and forth on this, taking something of a middle course. I mean, he has released a number of documents, including almost all of the legal memos the Justice Department wrote during the Bush years that guided this program, some of which have been filled with absolutely shocking details. So that was transparent to some extent. But he also has obviously held back on a number of things when he's been advised that it will hurt national security. So, for instance, he didn't release the photographs of detainees being tormented in various ways recently because he was afraid that it might stir up some kind of anti-American backlash. And there are other areas where his Justice Department has asserted national security rather than opening up secrets. And there have been a number of critics saying that they think that Obama has been too much like Bush in over-asserting national security secrets.
Panetta at the CIA also had to deal with this issue of rendition, of taking prisoners and then having them transported to countries where they might undergo torture or really intensive interrogation techniques. Where has Panetta come down on the rendition program?
Well, it's interesting, and I think surprising to many critics of rendition, that Panetta and the Obama administration are continuing the rendition program, which they say they're going to do differently than the Bush administration did. In the Bush years, this program just grew exponentially and resulted in a number of allegations. The people who the CIA picked up and basically abducted and sent over to foreign prisons to be interrogated, many of those people alleged that they were hideously tortured. So what Panetta told me was that they're going to monitor it much more closely, and they're going to make sure that nobody gets sent to a country where they torture or abuse prisoners, and that we will keep tabs on them to make sure that they are treated humanely. Which sounds good, but it is actually what the Bush administration said too. This is a program, to be honest, that began during the Clinton years, and so there are a number of people inside the CIA who think that it's very effective. So they've been pushing Panetta and Obama to keep it going.
How credible do you find these assurances that people can be protected?
I think it's very hard. I mean, there are very few countries that live up to the United States standards of justice. So, I mean, even during the Clinton years, the CIA picked up a number of suspects and sent them to Egypt, and some of them were summarily executed. So it's very hard to say that you can find other countries that live up to our standards of human rights. And, I mean, I think it's asking for trouble, I think.
What's the logic of maintaining a rendition program? Isn't it designed to evade protections in U.S. law? Why would the United States government want to do that?
Well, actually, there are many people who think the rendition program is very effective. It's not necessarily just designed to evade U.S. law. What it's designed to do is pick up terror suspects around the world and capture them and deliver them into some form of justice, if not our own, and some have been brought to our country, but then to some other countries, an allied country that maybe will be able to prosecute these people. So some of them are taken to the countries that, you know, where they are citizens, and we're just sort of assisting other countries in bringing people to justice. I mean, in theory, I can see why it has an appeal, because, you know, it picks people up off the street who might be extremely dangerous terror suspects. But the question is whether the U.S. should be involved in bringing people into circumstances where they might be tortured, and we have laws that say we can't bring them to places that'll torture them. And then the question is, well, can we monitor this appropriately? And it's hard to do.
You know, it's interesting that Panetta's dilemma at the CIA is sort of parallel to Obama's, but they're different. I mean, Obama has to make a decision that's, to some extent, a political calculation, whether it's better for the country to honestly confront its past or to let some of that go unexamined so that he can build a national consensus to move forward on an important agenda on everything from healthcare to the economy to energy. Panetta has a managerial challenge. I mean, he needs to get his agency moving on a very important national security mission that might be undermined if he spends a long time going into investigations and recriminations on past deeds. And I'm wondering what your sense is of the extent to which Panetta's goals for the CIA, and obviously it does a lot more than interrogate people, to what extent his goals for the agency have been undermined by, you know, the looks, the investigation of its past.
Well, I think there is a great fear that he and others have over at the CIA that if they start opening criminal investigations or even disciplinary investigations into the counterterrorism staff, that it will hurt the morale of the agency and make the particularly tie up the time of the experts in counterterrorism at a time when we still face a threat from terrorism. So it is a real dilemma. Though I have to say that, and it's very much also what the Republicans on the Hill have been saying. They've been arguing that this is a dangerous course to take, and it's going to weaken the CIA if you hold people accountable for past abuse. It's one of the things that intrigues me about this argument, though, is that the military, of course, does this all the time. If there are allegations of war crimes, they investigate them. If obviously in Abu Ghraib, a number of people were charged with crimes. And part of the reason they do that is to keep high standards of discipline and also to learn lessons from things they did wrong in the past. And I think, you know, weighing on the other side of this argument is the question of whether the CIA has learned something from this period. Have they really decided that abuse is was unnecessary and wrong and off the table, or would we possibly slip back into this if there was another attack? And I think it's very unclear. So there's kind of a lot of confusion over the agency, and it's up to Panetta to try to straighten all of this out.
Well, Jane Mayer, thanks so much for joining us again.
Glad to be with you.
Jane Mayer, speaking with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker and is the author of The Dark Side. Dave Davies is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. Coming up, Roger Cohen, a New York Times columnist who took a chance and stayed in Tehran to witness the protests after foreign journalists were forced out of the country. This is Fresh Air. It's been difficult to get news from Iran because the government has forced out foreign reporters. But after the government revoked the press passes of foreign reporters, my guest Roger Cohen decided to take his chances and stay and continue covering the election protests until his visa expired. He arrived in Tehran 3 days before the election and remained there for 15 days. By the time he left, he was one of the only American reporters, if not the only American reporter, still in Iran. He returned to New York last week. Cohen is a columnist for the New York Times. He's a former foreign correspondent and foreign news editor for the Times. Cohen told me he took the risk of staying in Iran because he thought it was important to bear witness.
I have never witnessed anything quite like it. 3 million people moving through the streets in silence. Whenever there was a murmur, they would say sukut, sukut, which is Farsi for silence. And they had their arms raised. They were making the V sign for victory. This was not a narrow response to the election. This was not a bunch of students or a bunch of North Tehrani rich kids. There were students and shopkeepers, old and young. I saw people on crutches. And this was a massive and immediate response to what was perceived as this fraud. And I was deeply moved. I felt that I should go on as long as I could. I didn't go into hiding. I stayed. I was in a relatively little known residence hotel, but of course they could have found me if they wanted to. I did write to the head of the Ministry of Information press office on the day that my press pass was revoked and expired, and I asked for a renewal. I mean, I knew it was forlorn, but I wanted to have the record that I had done that. And I got neither a rejection nor, of course, an approval. I just got silence. So in that silence, I figured I'd carry on.
Okay, so you've described a massive and peaceful demonstration, but the atmosphere changed as the demonstrators were attacked by the Basiji. Why don't you describe what it was like to be in the middle of one of the demonstrations that where the demonstrators were tear gassed and clubbed.
The atmosphere got steadily worse, and it changed with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's vitriolic sermon of the Friday after the election. That was exactly 1 week after the election. He used Friday prayers to call all the foreign media agents of subversion, to tell Mousavi that if the street demonstrations continued, the blood would be on his hands, to side unequivocally with Ahmadinejad. And as you know, Terry, the supreme leader in the setup created by Khomeini, the supreme leader has traditionally sat above the fray, but sits literally at the flank of the prophet. So his authority is divine. So when he says there will be blood on the streets, it in effect gives divine sanction for bringing that blood to the streets. So on the Saturday, tens of thousands of people, not millions, tens of thousands defied the Ayatollah Khamenei's words and went out in the streets. There was a massive security presence. And I saw women being beaten and clubbed. One I remember particularly vividly limping toward me, and then we tried to comfort her, and she turned around. She wanted to go back into the heart of the demonstration. I myself got very badly tear gas, just walked into this. I wasn't sure if it was smoke or tear gas. It was tear gas, and was kind of choking. And there was a whole bunch of people next to me who were choking. We kind of dashed down this alley off Enkelab Revolution Avenue. And one of the signs of the massive support for the protesters in Tehran, and there are many, but one of them was always that doors were flung open in houses for people in distress. And we ducked into this hallway where an older woman had made a little fire in a bowl. I wasn't aware of this before, but fire smoke from a fire, actually dispels to some degree the effects of tear gas. So everybody was putting their head over this little fire over the smoke. And pitched battles, garbage on fire, alarms going off, windows getting smashed, police eddying back and forth. One of the interesting things that day was that the city police, dressed in their green uniforms, were actually being quite friendly. And I heard one pleading with a protester in front of him, just saying, "Look, I have a wife and kids too. Please just go home."
Did you have any close calls yourself while you were in Iran?
Well, I did at this demonstration that I described, and running from police, beating people while being tear gassed, and that was very unpleasant. But I wasn't shot at, although I heard gunfire. But it was a very emotional and draining experience, especially in the last 5 or 6 days, when I felt a tremendous responsibility. I mean, the chances these days, given communication and the interconnected world we live in, the chances of being almost alone as an American journalist, on a story of those dimensions, just because everybody else had to leave, are extremely remote. But it happened, and so I really hardly slept the last 5 or 6 days, and I feel a connection with Iran. And Iran, Terry, has aspired. It had the first democratic revolution in Asia in 1905, and it was demanding something called a constitution, and so it was called the Constitutional Revolution against the Qajar dynasty. And intermittently, ever since, Iranians have looked for some form of liberal democracy. And I think the tragedy of Iran is that these two currents, the very strong, profound Islamic faith of the country, the clerical current, if you like, and the liberal democratic current, which is equally strong, there's no reason, ultimately, that they shouldn't coexist. And the Islamic Republic has had some very significant achievements, but as these recent events demonstrated, has not finally been able to get those two forces into some balance that brings Iranians together and overcomes the pain of exile of millions of Iranians and draws the country toward, its potential, which is huge.
My guest is Roger Cohen, a columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is New York Times columnist Roger Cohen. He covered the protest in Tehran after the election. So you had decided to stay in Iran until your visa ran out, even though your press pass was revoked, as all foreign journalists' press passes were. When your visa was up, that meant it was time for you to leave. But when you left and people examined your visa and your passport, they'd see your name. And for anybody who was following this, they'd know you were the reporter who was illegally getting information out from Iran back to the United States. So did you leave with some trepidation knowing that you could be arrested on your way out?
I did, yeah, and I was given an extremely bad time at Khomeini Airport. Looking back, I think I was so exhausted that I wasn't really as alert as you know as I might have been. It was very unpleasant. It was quite humiliating. I was virtually strip searched and. 5 minutes was devoted to the examination of each pen, and it was pretty horrible. But
did you think you weren't going to get out?
I didn't know, and I was also this sounds ridiculous, but I was worried. You know, my visa expired at midnight, and my flight was at 3 a.m. of the following day, and. This search went on for so long that I was worried that, I mean, come 2 minutes past midnight, they could say I had overstayed my visa, you know, which given everything else just sounds almost comical, I guess. But knowing Iran the way I do, I knew that I didn't want to get my passport stamped any time after midnight because... And anyway, in the end, I got my passport stamped at maybe 4 minutes to midnight. So the whole thing was, it was very tense and it was very unpleasant.
So when you were done with that unpleasant experience and you got on the plane, what were you thinking?
I was, I think I was not, in fact, relieved, which maybe I should have been. I was upset. I thought quite seriously about staying. But then I thought about Nazila and other colleagues and what might happen, and also, of course, what might happen.
You'd be putting them at risk.
Yes, and I also thought, of course, about what might happen to me. There'd been other journalists arrested at that point who disappeared from view, and I was talking to my wife, who has, pretty long experience at this point of me in war zones. I told her I was thinking of staying, and she was pretty smart. She didn't say anything. She just said, "Well, when you make up your mind, let me know." And but of course, I knew what what she didn't want me to do. So in the end, I left. But I left thinking it was unlikely that I'd get back anytime soon, and I left just feeling. Feeling I was betraying the people whose acts I'd been writing about.
I'm curious who was on the plane with you when you took that 3 a.m. plane out of Tehran. Was it people who were feeling endangered and trying to get away? Or like who were the other people?
I don't know. I mean, there were a bunch of very sleepy people, it being 3 in the morning.
Right.
So, basically Lufthansa put the lights out and everyone, tried to sleep. And I slept myself, actually. I was just exhausted and drained. But I think there was some, you know, there were some business people. There were, you know, there's a huge diaspora, millions of people, Khomeini globalized Iranians. And as you know, there's a large community here, particularly in California, but also very large communities in Britain and Germany. And I was on a, of course, there are no U.S. flights into Iran. And I was on a Lufthansa flight to Frankfurt. And I think there were quite a lot of German Iranians, you know, who'd gone back to see families. The flight was, it wasn't full. It was maybe two-thirds full, if that.
You've said before that, in a way, journalism is a young man's game. You know, like when you get the call to go to Lebanon in the middle of the night, it's one thing. If you're 25, it's another thing. If you're, you know, 40 and you have a family. And I'm wondering, I mean, you're married, you have children. I'm wondering if you didn't expect to conduct this kind of journalism, you know, in a country like Iran, when you were officially banned from reporting there at this stage in your career, this stage in your life.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shock, Terry. And you know, as a colonist, you just choose where you go. So I feel strange thing to say, but I feel fate just kind of drew me into Iran this year, and it hasn't really stopped from the beginning of the year. And now I have that feeling that I had after Bosnia, that you know, there's something kind of welling inside me that I, you know, will still have to get out somehow, which probably means a book. But you know, I haven't moved forward into that yet. But one thing about journalism is it can always surprise you. And I think I wrote in one column that, you know, we're supposed to be hardened and able to move on, and we're just voyeurs. You know, we look at one story, then we look at another. And I think every now and again we just get ambushed by a story. And I've certainly been ambushed by Iran. And your subject turns the tables on you and has you in its grasp rather than you deciding when you want to move on.
Well, Roger Cohen, thank you very much for talking with us, and thank you so much for the reporting that you did from Tehran, and for sticking it out there as long as you possibly could. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. Great to talk to you again.
Roger Cohen is a columnist for The New York Times. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Minhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two comics who are good friends and get on each other's nerves. We talk with Michael Ian Black and Michael Showalter, the creators and stars of the new Comedy Central series, Michael and Michael Have Issues. They were also in the MTV sketch comedy series, The State, which just came out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.